I'm Jason Klom, and this is Comedy on Vinyl. Comedy on Vinyl podcast, my guest this week to talk about his father's life, talk about all kinds of stuff related to his father and his own work, is Spike Jonze Jr. Thank you so much for being here.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
I'm glad you agreed to do this. I think we talked years ago, and then I just dropped the ball or some crap happened, and it never, and I've been wanting to do this for a long time. Just because I love your father's work, but I don't think I really discovered it until talking to people on this show, specifically Dr. Demento and Peter Schickele, both the two of whom, obviously, their first records were your dad's records. Right. Was that the case with you? Were your dad's records the first comedy you ever heard?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, I had no, you know, I thought every band had somebody that played cowbells. I never thought it was special to my family. I thought every band did until I got a little more mature and figured it out. But mm-hmm. Yeah, his was the, as a kid, I mean, it was great to listen to.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's, how could you not get sucked in? I mean, I've also interviewed, I've interviewed a ton of people who have brought him up. I interviewed a gentleman named Eben Schletter. I don't know if you've ever met him, but he was once tasked with doing a parody of your dad's work on Mr. Show with Bob and David on HBO years ago.
Uh-huh.
And it was great. It was great. He's like, well, yeah, of course I'll do that. I know his work inside and out. I can do a weird sounding sort of Spike Jonze, you know, gunshot. This sound is, and it's great. He does a great job. You grew up with it, but I don't know even where to begin with this, because like there's so much to your life and how you interact with him. Let's talk about this first. What was the kind of comedy in the house? Again, comedy records were new. He was one of the first people doing comedy records, period. What kind of stuff was in the house? What comedy were you absorbing as a kid?
I was thinking about that earlier today. First Family.
Oh yeah.
Was one of the first. My neighbor had Belle Barth, who I'm sure you know. So it was always wonderful to go over to his house because that's where we could hear the, you know, Belle and that group of people and that type of humor.
Mm-hmm.
It was. I mean, obviously Carlin and then all the staples, everybody that we love. But mm-hmm. I was a big fan of Stan Freberg.
Yeah, yeah.
Who, to me, is just the penultimate. You don't get better than him.
What's so crazy is, like, I love hearing that, but, you know, I know that I've heard a million times that Weird Al will talk about his big influences, and your dad is in there, also mm-hmm. Stan Freberg, also a bit of Alan Sherman. But what's so interesting to me is that your dad's approach and Stan Freberg's approach, so different, if only because Stan Freberg openly hated pop music. Did your dad have any... Because his materials reverence, I think, was a little higher. Did he like pop music, or was he also trying to poke fun, but in a different way?
He wasn't a fan of pop music because it basically was the item that he didn't understand. He understood the music, the big band stuff, the classical, all the stuff that the music that he satirized and played with, that he understood. But when it came, you'd say, when it came to a Papa Ooh Mau Mau, which was a very big hit then, mm-hmm. what can I, Spike Jonze, do to that song
fair.
That hasn't already been done?
That's fair. That's absolutely fair. So I can see his frustration. And then again, Stan Freberg, his way of doing it is I'll do what they're doing, but to the nth degree, I'll make them sound like an idiot, which was generally what he would do.
Exactly.
It's so interesting that, you know, one had essentially seemingly a bit of comedic writer's block and the other ran with it. Your dad could still do his own thing, of course. What did he do in the face of that? Was it sticking to the standards, or like did he find a new way to play with music?
He actually became straighter. I mean, it's almost...
That's so funny.
He sort of became like a comedy Lawrence Welk, if
okay.
you understand yep. what that
sure.
is.
Sure. Yeah,
he wanted to play great music. He wanted his audience to always hear great music. And so it became straighter. His band was great, but they got rid of the check suits. They got rid of shooting off the guns and things like that.
Okay.
He sort of thought if he played it down a little bit, because he really did. He said once he was recording an album, Elvis came out with a new record, and he had to go back into the studio and drop more garbage into the can and stuff, because there was no way they were going to compete with that.
Oh my goodness. Now this is a totally side question, but this has come up before that Stan Freberg, okay, this is, it's not that complicated, I guess, but I always have trouble keeping track of it. Stan Freberg, for instance, he's a good for instance of this. Some of his sound effects were given to him, his sound effects like equipment were given to him by the Firesign Theater, who had recovered him from the garbage at CBS. Eventually, I saw a lot of those go on for auction once Stan Freberg passed away. Do any of your dad's sound effect things survive? Like, for instance, do you have any of like a noisemaker or anything?
I have a few things.
Great.
There's a nucleus of Spike Jones admirers, let's just say, maybe a half a dozen. And each of them have been able to pick up stuff as it went along. I was 16 when my dad died, so I had no sense of what would be valuable, what wouldn't be valuable. And either did my family. So
sure.
There's a guy who does the great Spike Jones. His name is Carl, and he has one of the sets of my dad's original cowbells.
Oh, wow.
An octave and a half of tune cowbells, which are, they sound fabulous. So there are those elements all across the country.
Yeah. Where did your dad, okay, there's a quote that is attributed to you that is essentially, basically his comedy wouldn't have worked unless you can tune a gunshot to C sharp or whatever the hell it was. It's like, it doesn't work. How did he come across this stuff and get it tuned? Where did this come from?
He was a perfectionist. He was a drummer, basically. Mm-hmm. So he knew what the rhythms needed to sound like. And he would go out of his way to get a goat to take on the road that in the key of C. So when he cued it, that goat went, and the audience obviously went nuts. So it was an expensive bit.
Yeah.
But he also had a harp player who who was absolute phenomenal harpist, female. Mm-hmm. And all she would do in the entire 2.5 hour show was play 8 bars of Holiday for Strings. In the interim, she was knitting. And she, over the years, it came out to be this 36-foot long scarf. And she also smoked a cigar, which they did in those days.
Oh my God. That is insane. And I mean that in the best way. That's an insane level of dedication. Again, perfectionism, yes, but dedication to a bit, that is to be admired. And it is also, I was debating whether or not to use this word because it gets overused, but I try not to overuse it. Genius gets overused as well, and I think that also applies. But it is kind of proto-punk. It is so very off the beaten path, so very, again, committed to making it work in this way that where it should never work, that I'm surprised it's not a bigger story. I'm surprised I didn't know that story already, I guess is what I'm saying. The goat thing is too much. That is amazing and beautiful.
Right.
That is sublime. Yeah. That is almost the definition of it. That kind of, wow. Wow. And I know that I've also read that, you know, at some point he became a little dismayed that people only thought of him as a comedy musician, which is hard because that's the way you're making your living and that's the way you make your name. Obviously, that's what you're going to be known as. What was his training and what do you think he did besides kind of going straight, as it were, almost going straight and doing, I know he did some straight records, of course. What do you think he did to sort of subvert that or try and shift people's perspective on him?
He would always have, when he was working in clubs and when he was working on the road, he had Spike Jones's other orchestra, which were 30 of the best players out of his band and other bands. And they played dance music, which was phenomenal, and it sounded great, but not a sound effect near it. It was just wonderful singers. And so any opportunity he had, he would try and do that. But people started saying, if I wanted to hear that kind of music, I'd go hear Tchaikovsky.
Sure, sure.
I want to hear Spike Jonze. So yeah, as you were saying, it was tough for him to fight it, but that's what the people wanted.
Yeah. I mean, somebody like me grows up in a culture where I think comedy is also more valued in general. It is, for other people, not me, for other people, a very easy way to make money. Like, some people are so good at it. It is a respected way to move your way up. And I would imagine maybe for his generation and for all of his training also, it must have been like a hard thing to... Do you think if it had been in a different time, he would have felt differently? Or was he just not deep down a comedian? He just happened to be very good at comedy.
He happened to be very good at comedy. When he first started with his band, the Steady Slickers, mm-hmm, and they were playing places, he would leave the announcements and all of the introductions to either a girl singer in the band or the lead singer or somebody else. He was in the back playing with the washboards and stuff like that. He wanted nothing to do with being in front of an audience.
Hmm. That's so interesting to me.
Yeah, it is. And then his humor developed out of that. There are a couple of places that I've just recently read in Jordan Young's book,
yeah,
where people said he would say the worst jokes in the world. And it's hard for me to believe that because I know his humor. I mean, he's the man that came up with an album titled Dinner Music for People Who Aren't Very Hungry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's same guy.
Yeah. Yeah. What was his sense of humor at home? Let's say we could start there.
Very little.
Yeah.
Very little.
Was he serious? Was he very serious? Or
very,
just
very okay. serious?
All right.
Yeah, very serious. Serious about his work. Serious about and the time that I grew up. My sisters, we all grew up as the family. He was playing Vegas. He was playing this place and mm-hmm. that place. But he was more concerned about the big career,
mm-hmm.
What people would think of Spike Jonze and what he could do. And he was always trying to do, he wanted to do an animated series. He wanted mm-hmm. to do a different kind of a band on the road type of thing. And so that's where his focus was,
mm-hmm.
day in and day out, which yeah. I don't blame him for it.
Sure. I mean, it makes things, I'm sure it makes his focus elsewhere very difficult, and that's probably hard to take as a family, I would imagine.
Right, like, right.
That's got to be its own thing. But it couldn't, I guess, you know, the one thing I was like, okay, if I interview you today, I'm like, okay, what might be a sensitive topic? And to be fair, I didn't ask you if there was anything. If there's something off topic, you tell me. But then it also occurred to me halfway through my thoughts, like, oh, no, he still calls himself Spike Jonze Jr. So it couldn't be, there can't be that bad of a relationship between the two.
You know, like, no, I'm a huge fan.
Yeah.
I mean, people, when I was a kid, I would come home from school and I would listen to my dad's records inside in my bedroom, mm-hmm. and there came a time where he became too ill
mm-hmm.
to perform, and he had some contracts left with Harris Club and a couple of places in Vegas and stuff like that. So I had seen the show and heard the stuff so many times that they flew me up. I think the first place was to Vegas, and they said, look at the show, and then we want you to replace your dad. Because they were doing three shows a night.
Oh, wow.
And with his asthma and emphysema, I mean, which was just beyond in thinking about it, how difficult it was.
Yeah.
The third show is just, so they said, okay, let's bring in the kid.
Yeah.
And first time I got to pick up the gun and go, bam, it was like, angels started singing. It was under the circumstances not terrific, but
yeah. Did you, I mean, okay, kids are more sensitive than we give them credit for, but how much of the weight did you feel or understand as you were doing this, the weight of the whole thing? As a 16 year old kid, are you aware my dad is dying and I'm also performing this stuff, or are you just hoping against hope it just works out, and you're doing this for him.
Doing it for him.
Yeah.
That's basically it.
Yeah.
There was one time we were, I think, at the Showboat Hotel in Las Vegas or whatever, and there were stairs that led down. He was in the lounge. There were stairs that led down to the stage. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how it was, but he happened to be sitting there. He saw me do a bit, and he gave me like a, you know, one of these types of things. I didn't move. I said, you know, how wonderful is that?
Yeah. Holy shit. Yeah. Sorry. Holy sorry for the language. Right. Sorry for the language, but it's beautiful.
Holy friggin' shit.
Yeah. Now, you swear all you want, by the way. I normally do. I'm just trying to cut it off in case you don't want me to. But yeah, that was the thing that I read that most broke my heart, but also made me just so fascinated with, isn't true for everybody, but wanting your dad to trust you is a common trope in definitely in American culture, and to trust you enough, right. Not just to but to trust you with everything. Hi, I've worked for this my whole life. This is what I've worked up to. This could be the last thing I get to do. And I'm going to let my 15-year-old kid just bang it out. And you did it. And I'm just like, wow. Wow.
Cue him. You know, yeah. It was, I was like the Justin Bieber of the cowbells. I look back at pictures of myself when I was 15, 16, and I don't have the tattoos that Justin had, but there's a similarity there.
Yeah. Who was I thinking? I saw a picture of your dad younger, I think maybe roughly as he was graduating high school. There's one on Wikipedia where he's a teenager. And I'm like, oh, Leonardo DiCaprio was the first thing I saw. Then I also realized, oh, so nobody's made a movie about your dad's life. That needs to happen, first of all, because I would pay good money to see that. But come on, Leonardo DiCaprio, get on it.
Yeah. He was one of the people that we thought of, and we have a couple of ideas floating around.
Good.
That could be fun and terrific, and but you, of all people, know how tough it is to get something made today.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. Wow. I now need to know how musical you are and have been since then. I know that, you know, you've got a ton of TV producing work under your belt, but I need to know musically who you are.
Oh, that can't take much time. I play drums because my dad played drums. I used to have a drum set in my bedroom, and in fact, it happened to be his. And I would play a lot and have a great time with it. And then I got to the point where it just wasn't. I mean, I had my band and did all that stuff, and pretty musical. Played the cowbells really well. Played the all the instruments. But then it didn't get. It wasn't fun any longer. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, how I had perceived my dad in Vegas and concerts and recordings and all that other sort of stuff. It was a struggle to try and get a book. So I became a producer.
Yeah.
Go behind the camera rather than in front of it. But if I had to play drums today, I wouldn't.
Fair enough.
I'd say no, I'll pass. What else you got in mind?
I mean, you've got to love it to keep doing it. And I mean,
true.
You know, why the hell bother? I guess, you know, hearing the fact that he's a drummer, I mean, that is such a common trope in comedy. I always go back to Mel Brooks. It's the one thing people love to bring up is that Mel Brooks was a drummer first. And I mean, come on, the rim shot's the rim shot for a reason. Like it is rhythm.
Exactly. And right. Gary Marshall was a drummer.
Oh, yeah. Right.
There's a ton of funny people who were drummers. My dad was a professional drummer. That's how he made his living. Mm-hmm. And he was, I'm sure you're familiar with the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah.
My dad was comparable in his days to doing all the studio work and radio and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Comparable to a Hal Blaine.
Okay. Okay. That now makes sense. Because I had read briefly he was part of the group. now I don't know, remember if he's on the recording, but part of the group that backed Bing Crosby for the first recording of White Christmas. Is he performing on that then?
Yes.
Okay. So yes. I did understand that correctly. All right.
Right. Okay.
I'm just going to make a quick note. There's a blip on my end. I want to make sure I fix that in post. Okay. So he was on that recording. All right. So now I've understood correctly. So what was the impetus for him even wanting to add comedy to it? Because again, normally comedy people don't start doing something else and then saying, oh, you know what? Let's make this thing wacky. Let's make this thing goofy as hell. Why?
He had a very unique bent sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to believe that when he put his first band together, simultaneously recording as a drummer, their first rehearsals were in a cemetery in Hollywood.
Holy shit. Okay.
It's the only room they could get. I'm not sure. But that's sort of where his humor is. Let's go to the cemetery and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And then they come up with a record called The Fear Is Face,
mm-hmm.
which sort of launched him. And he just had a weird sense of humor, and he appreciated, loved classical music, all types of music. That's why the stuff was as good as it is.
Mm-hmm.
He understood it. The guys weren't just showing up and playing the stuff on the page.
Right.
They brought their own sensibility and timing to the band, and so many of them were brilliant.
Yeah, that's impressive too. The idea that he would take any input on something that feels like it had to have been finely tuned by one person. But I love that this is a multi-input thing. I wouldn't have expected that, honestly.
Yeah. He used to say, give me, with a couple of his key band members, he would say, give me five jokes and we have a song, we have a hit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was basically his formula, his criteria.
Wow.
Five jokes and we can all go home.
That's crazy. That's nuts. I mean, that's also one of the more simple comedy formulas I've ever heard in my life. I love it. The simplicity of it makes me think I can do comedy music all of a sudden. I can't, for the record. I can do music that sounds terrible and therefore makes you laugh. That's its own thing entirely. Do you remember the first time you saw him perform live?
He was going out on a tour, I think 1963. He was mm-hmm. playing with the Beverly Hillbillies. It was one of those shows that were, you know, different acts, Homer and Jethro, a couple of other people,
mm-hmm.
Christy Minstrels, Beverly Hillbillies. I was in love with Donna Dixon.
Sure.
This day.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at the Long Beach Auditorium, and I just sat there with my mouth open. I didn't have a seat. I stayed, I think it was stage right or stage left, either one, and just watched and saw it done for the first time and couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Just couldn't. The timing, you couldn't put a piece of paper through any part of two sections.
Mm-hmm.
And what a stupid metaphor that is.
I know what you mean, though.
it really is stupid, but that's when I saw him.
Wow. Did it change how you saw him? Like, and if so, I'd love to know in what way it changed your perspective on who he was.
Oh, I was, you know, who else has got a dad like this? Nobody, you know?
Yeah.
I was proud, I was thrilled. He would yell at me. It happens as a kid or whatever.
Sure.
But watching him do what he did and was able, because he liked to work out of an office that he built at home,
mm-hmm.
he would bring all the guys over, writers over, and do album concepts and stuff like that at mm-hmm. the house. So I had sort of an outside vision of it.
Yeah.
And just loved every bit of it.
but then seeing it practically in front of a group of people, did he, when he performed, who was he facially? Was he expressive? Was he stone faced? 'Cause he's got to get all the rhythms right. What was he like in that way?
He was more worried about how the band was. He was very concentrated. I've seen a couple of the television shows that we put together for videos, mm-hmm. and you can tell he's directing the cameras where to go, and he's live on there in a wide shot, mm-hmm. but he's still telling everybody what to do. So I don't think he was nervous or concerned. He just wanted the experience to be the best it could be for the audience.
Yeah, that's
cool. He always said the sound was, you don't have good sound, you don't have a joke. And mm-hmm. which made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So he was very technical and interested in how the stuff would come off.
I also like that he had a sense of humor about things sound, how things sound too, because the album you mentioned earlier is all treated as though this is a test for your hi-fi and has mm-hmm. all this beautiful sound, but he's also playing with it at the same time. It's conceptual. I like records that know their records, because I find that the artists making them tend to, I don't know, they explore new things with how a record can be made. And I love that your dad, who is practically the originator of the modern comedy record, also played with the format as soon as he could, too. I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dinner Music was his first. He, as you said, his concept was demonstrate your hi-fi. Mm-hmm. And basically, if your hi-fi is still working at the end of this record, you've got a wonderful piece of machinery, which was absolutely true. Mm-hmm. And he would do things. I remember he'd do a version of the Black and Blue Danube Waltz.
Uh-huh.
And he'd say, let's listen to it from the Paris Symphony Orchestra. So all you'd hear is this tuba playing the black, the Blue Danube Waltz. And he would say, rather empty, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But High Fidelity brings it along, and then you've got, it's that kind of stuff.
I love it. That's so good. Was he, this is a side question, but you grew up in just a period of time and your dad was of a certain generation. Was he a nut? Was he a technophile? Did he like to buy a lot of good audio equipment? And did you have the good stuff at home, the good recorders and the good
stereos? Oh, yeah,
stereos?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I remember in his office, he had a great rack. He had a great setup, all tubes. Mm-hmm. There weren't any transistors at the time. There wasn't, it was all great sounding stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was nice to be introduced to that.
Oh, I bet. Did he record stuff at home? Did you record stuff as a family, since that was the new technology for home?
No, we never got that far. He was pretty much on his own when he did that kind
okay.
of stuff.
Okay, fair enough.
He never said, Spike, come in and sing. No, he knew better.
I missed a beat in my research. How long did you continue doing his show for? And was it till after he passed? Did you continue doing it for a while?
Yeah, I did. The first time I took it over, he had passed. It was like in April, and he had passed on May 1st.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like a 30-day period where he was just, he kept getting worse and worse and worse.
Sure.
And he was no longer able to go on the road at all. So I filled in with the three shows at the various places, because he still had the commitments. And they said, yeah, the kid worked out all right. Nobody shot, and then he passed away. Mm-hmm. There were more gigs that were still committed to. And then I put my own type of band together, which I would have things like, I hope this isn't offensive, you never know, but three Nazis singing the way we were. memories like the corners of our minds because of the way we were, I hope you don't get...
That's a little more experimental than I would have expected from the son of Spike Jones.
I didn't know any better either.
You're trying stuff. At a very young age, by the way. That sounds like the kind of stuff a lot of 16-year-olds might cook up, you know?
Uh-huh.
It's like, I know what's offensive. I know that offensive sometimes makes people laugh. I know that juxtaposition is a thing. I mean, you know. My goodness
gracious.
Yeah,
it was, you know, the audiences, some got it. Some were still expecting Cocktails for Two, Holiday for Strings, the standards.
Of course.
And we're disappointed if we didn't do them.
Mm-hmm.
And understandable.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, I get that. I get that. But I also get maybe getting tired or anxious, especially that young. Especially that young. And wanting to try something new already. I mean, this is like, it's got to be a weird feeling. Like, this is my dad's stuff, but like, I'm not my dad. And I'm a human who wants to express himself at again, a very critical time. That must have been a weird feeling for you internally.
It was. Yeah. And we played those rooms and stuff like that, and then came back to LA and played the Comedy Store, we played the Improv, we played all of those places, but we were a big footprint. We were like 10 people. So we started getting a younger group in there. In fact, somebody mentioned to me the other day, I don't know if it's true, but Robin Williams opened for us at the Comedy Store.
Wow.
In the major room. And that was some time.
Yeah. Holy cow. That is a new audience, a new room, a new atmosphere for that. I'm honestly surprised that that concept then lasted as long as it did then, based on when he would have been around to even introduce you. I mean, the fact that it persisted says something for it. But also, obviously, his fandom continues in people who definitely weren't alive when he even, ended his career. I mean, what do you know, obviously nostalgia plays a big part in that, but what do you think contributes to the staying power of this very weird music that I love every time I hear it?
Thank you. I didn't do it. Kids, I get phone calls all the time. I was doing a retrospective on television commercials, mm-hmm. and we're reaching out to the sponsors to get clearances. And I remember speaking to the chairman at the time of Dr. Pepper.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, before you start, I just want you to know that my two kids, who are 7 and 9, let's say, just listened to Cocktails for Two over and over and over and over again last night.
Mm-hmm.
So it's passed on like that. And kids love it because they don't have to tie it to anything. It's not... it's just funny to them, and funny voices and singing. And,
that's fair.
Does that answer?
It does. Anything? No, it does. I think it's an easy entry point. And it also, I mean, I do not know, I'm realizing now, I don't know what much younger people than me, I don't know what their exposure is to cartoons. Cartoons would have been my exposure to classical music first and foremost.
Right.
But whatever exposes you to it, sometimes you're a kid, you assume that that's the theme to the cartoon. People must have made it up. There are probably some young kids who are like, oh, well, Spike Jones must have written them himself. So you don't get that level of it. But I think it, because it's beautiful music, it always appeals. And of course, funny sound effects and funny voices. That's a friggin' match made in heaven.
Right. Three of my dad's key players, when the band broke up, finally
mm-hmm.
went to work for a gentleman by the name of Jay Ward.
Oh, wow.
Who did the Rocky and Bullwinkle series.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because of their knowledge of sound effects and their timing and everything else, they worked perfectly well with that franchise.
Wow.
And with that company. So, and some others went to Hanna-Barbera.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't an accident, so to speak. These guys knew what to do.
It's also evidence that your dad was not wrong to be looking into making a cartoon show. Come on. It would have been good. It would have been good. There's no doubt about it. Oh, my goodness gracious. What is it also like to have to... because I talk to people who, some of whom are archivists for their family, like for their parents' work and stuff. I don't know if you... do you have any, have you had to do any archive work for him, or do you generally, are other people in charge of that and you get to put it, package it together?
I wish I was Bermuda Schwartz with his collection and his tie-in and it, you know, and I heard him, I've met him a few times,
yeah,
but I had never heard him articulate it as well as when I heard him on your show.
Oh, thank you. I thank you again for something that's nothing to do with me. We're both doing it.
And I mean, the man was, he just knew what it was like, and he saved everything, as you know, and just, yeah. I wasn't like that so much, but there were three or four guys who are Spike Jonze archivists. They're also fans of other players and musicians and mm-hmm. stuff like that, but their Spike Jonze catalog goes for days and days wow. and days, and they're always coming up with new stuff.
That's crazy.
On Facebook, they started the Spike Jonze Appreciation fan page, mm-hmm. Stuff comes up all the time.
That's one of those things that feels like, you know, provided no rift ever happens, that is almost an ideal, because you can't have four sets of eyes on your own. And I know archivists, again, who, if they haven't saved everything, are constantly on the lookout for stuff that they know they can't get. And I think in some situations, know that some fans have and some fans don't want to let go of it. But it's nice to hear that there are four, like this group of fans who are like, oh no, let's all contribute to this man's legacy, which is crazy. I mean, that's a hell of a way to keep it alive.
Yeah, and that's the idea. That's their philosophy. Wow. So it's they all get along very well, and they all share the same type of humor and mm-hmm. appreciation.
What about any of the checked suits? Did any of those survive? Any of that kind of stuff still around?
Three of them.
Oh,
we
wow.
happen to have two.
Amazing.
That are in excellent shape. We have one that. He had a gold and white, but that has a couple of moth-eaten holes in
sure,
it.
Sure.
Ted Herring has got one that is green and orange, and I mean the combinations were fabulous.
Yeah.
So there are a few of those which I'm happy about.
Yeah. Oh, that's good to hear. I always want to know if that stuff is still around. Just. More out of curiosity than anything, because sometimes I'll check a website for this person and like they've got it and I'm looking at the way they're storing it and I'm just, oh goodness, please tell me that you're taking care of, you know, you always get worried because
yeah.
I know it's seemingly incidental, but I think as we all know, if you touch a piece of something that has to do with the history that you love so much, it just flashes you to whatever. I've got a few things in this room right now that I just look at them every once in a while to remind myself of the things that I love. And I don't know, it's just... I don't know what the hell I'm trying to say. I'm just rambling. I'm just excited to talk to you. This is
what in the room, and you don't have to show it, uh-huh. but what is like one of your primary?
Oh, okay. Did you ever watch the television show News Radio? No biggie if you didn't watch it.
Of course.
Okay, good.
Yes,
all right. I like hearing of course, by the way. So I've got a podcast about News Radio because it's my favorite sitcom. I've got a few that are up top, like with it almost, but News Radio just always stuck with me. It's so funny. Literally everything I could show you is just out of frame, but I've got a mug from the show, two mugs right here. I have one of Phil Hartman's ties over here that was supposed to have been destroyed, but the lady realized, oh, I did not destroy that. Oops. And she gave it to me. Then there's an episode you may remember of News Radio where it all took place on a spaceship because they went insane that final episode. I have Phil Hartman's suit from that episode, which is A, the only spacesuit I think that survives from that show, and B, the only custom piece that was made for him that survives from the show. So I have that up on the wall over here. So, and those are things that like I can't touch because thank goodness they're behind glass, but you know, it's just I look at them and they I don't know, they balance me. I also feel very fortunate that I have them. It's another thing I can't imagine. Yeah.
It's an appreciation of this industry.
Yeah. It's a big part of it.
Which you have and I have and many people that are participating. It's not easy to do. It's not easy to be it. but you fall in love with this stuff, so there's nothing else that is gonna get in its way.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to become a barista. Get over it. you're going to be a fan of great music and communities like the Weird Al community.
Oh my gosh, that I will tell you, that is one of, that's, if I get in a room with a group of those guys, A, I know they're going to be more nerdy than I am, and I love it. I enjoy watching this group of nerds get together, and then also, there's never really any competition, but there is this weird camaraderie that comes with, like, no, I was just talking to a friend of mine. We went to the New York Times Magazine, did a shoot beginning of 2020, and everybody had to dress up like Weird Al, and my friend was there, and everybody's like, hey, who's seen the most Weird Al shows? And he just kept holding up his hand and holding up his hand and holding up his hand, and he won by a long shot. And at the same time, like, I love my friend Kurt, and I'm like, wow, you nerd, you're the biggest nerd. And there's just, I don't know, there's something about that community where you can, I don't know, it makes you feel good about yourself.
He's one of the great lyricists. I feel embarrassed. I went to a party. Dr. Demento had a party for his wife at the time, who had just passed away, and mm-hmm. Al was there. And as I was walking in, I just said, there's a song you did where the lyrics are just so good, so perfect, so wonderful. Oh, good. What was it? I forgot.
Sure.
So I was so embarrassed.
We've
but,
all done
you know,
it.
Doing this, but it was genuine appreciation to whatever the song was.
Well, that's the thing too, is like anything that beautiful, and to reuse the word sublime in some cases, makes you kind of stupid. It makes you love a thing so much that you can't remember what you loved about it, especially under pressure,
Right, especially when you're talking to the master.
Of course. You know, but I totally understand that feeling. It's like, yeah, I love the episode. If I talk to the people who created News Radio, and then I will totally blank, and they'll, aren't you a fan of the show? They will sarcastically say, and it's, you know, happens all the time.
Right.
Those are the moments that are, you have to cherish for how stupid you feel. You know,
truly, truly, the Stoics say it's okay to fail.
How often do you, and again, no pressure, but how often do you re-listen to your dad's work? I mean, it is, I think, infinitely re-listenable. It's some of the stuff that holds up the best, and maybe because it's based on classic stuff, but also pretty timeless comedy, but.
I would have to say I listen to his stuff a couple of tracks every 3-4 weeks.
Yeah.
Either because I'm looking for a pick-me-up, or I just miss hearing this phrase, like I mentioned Carmen at the Opera to you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's 14 minutes of just brilliant music and performing, and it was done live, no overdubs, no nothing.
Yeah.
And so as a person who understands the formula and the process, to know that is, you know, to know what they do now, I just love that stuff.
Yeah.
So I would say more often than not.
I have
10 favorites.
Yeah, please tell me.
Mm-hmm. Liebestraum is one.
Uh-huh.
Carmen is another one. What else do I happen to love? I happen to love a couple of his later things. He did an album called 60 Years of Music America Hates Best. There are a couple of tracks on that I like.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I'm trying to think of something else. In the shower, I'm going to be brilliant.
Yeah, of course. You know? No, of course. Absolutely.
So there are more, and I'll text you them.
That's fair. How about, were there ever any sort of written but unperformed, unexplored pieces that ended up, you know, in his archive that you know of? Anything he wrote?
I happen to know of it. And the person that has it said he's not going to let me hear it ever.
I'm sorry.
It's a version of I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus, but it's actually, I think it's I Saw Mommy Screwing Santa Claus. And they recorded it just, they had recorded the regular version, the Spike Jonze version. And then they sent everybody out of the studio. I don't know how apocryphal this is, but and then they recorded "I Saw Mommy Screwing Santa Claus."
So somebody's got it. They're holding it hostage, is what it sounds like.
Absolutely.
Oh, come on now.
No, I know. I know. There's not enough money that this guy would ease.
Of course. Oh, my God. 'Cause I will say, one of the things I came across in my brief research was also your dad, you know, claimed he was tired of the censorship at, if I remember correctly, RCA. I'm curious what that level is. I'm sure it wasn't that, but like, what kind of stuff did he feel censored by or about?
He had a couple of records that were banned in Boston, either because of the political or drinking or booze or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I know about what you're talking about. The RCA, this radio show, thought he was way too over the top, way too, I don't know if it was political or whatever, but they didn't like some of the sounds, like that kind of today. They didn't like that. Uh-huh. And so they said, you better change it. And he said, no, I don't think so. 4 weeks later, Percy Faith is sitting in his chair and doing that Sunday show or whatever it was.
Wow.
So, you could tell how really they didn't like.
Wow.
Yeah.
I understand that there's perspective to be like, that's crazy today. I think that's overall crazy. That is censorship, you know, at least on the corporate level. That's very weird. That is that's the tamest commentary one can possibly make. I mean,
truly,
you know,
truly.
I mean, I'm sure he would have wanted to also say even more to Mr. Hitler in that song. But, you know, I mean, he still went pretty as tame, I guess, as he could have gotten away with on the radio. That is, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
We're talking about a lot of things, and a lot of these things are stressing me out.
I'm sorry.
No, come on. I asked about
That's
it. I wanted
I'm
to
here.
Know.
That's, yeah.
It's that, but it's mostly the, I want to hear this other version of the song that somebody wants to be a weirdo about. Here's what my brain is doing. My Indiana Jones brain is saying that belongs in a museum. That's, I'm just like, we need to be able to hear it. Let the people hear what kind of a weird, anyway. If somebody wanted my weird news radio shit for a museum, I'd happily put it in a museum. Nobody does. So for now, I'm the museum, you know.
Well, I'm thinking if anybody, it's not the only copy.
Right.
But if there was anybody, it would be somebody in your audience
who
might be aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing I didn't do is sing it. So they could figure it out.
What I would say is, if there is somebody listening who knows how to get a hold of that, I would love to hear it. But more importantly, Spike would love to hear it. And if you don't want me to play it for the world, which I would be happy to do, we've premiered more weird stuff on this podcast than some other shows. Would love to do it. But at the very least, I want Spike to hear the damn thing. And if I get it, I will not listen to it first. You listen to it first, as far as I'm concerned. Okay. So if you're out there and you can get that for me. I know some people, by the way, who will hear this and be like, I will do my best. Like, they'll, you have my sword. There are some people who will very much try if they can't do it.
They're in the car
right
now. Mm-hmm. Right.
They're turning it around on the freeway.
Exactly.
I know where to go. yeah, that's the kind of stuff. I'm literally getting chills when I talk about archival stuff and stuff that ought to be preserved and stuff that is lost. That's the thing, though. When stuff is lost, when people tell me, oh, yeah, this happened, but it ended up on the cutting room floor. We have no idea where it is. It's like, oh, no, please don't tell me that ever. And this is, I don't know. It's just, I don't like to say timeless, but that's the only way really to describe what it is. And re-listening it, every time I re-listen to an older piece of comedy, I'm always worried, will it age, except for with your dad's stuff, because there's what is there to age? It is
what it is,
pure comedy. It's not referential, really. It's not really of its time in terms of, you know, they don't talk about what's going on that much. It's always okay to hate Hitler, so I mean, that's also, that pretty much stays timely. I don't know. It's great stuff. From your perspective, if you're to tell the audience, what's a good album to get started on? What's a good one? Or song?
I would say No, go for the album. Don't just buy a song.
Yeah, that's fair.
The Best of Spike Jonze is an album that, which is now Sony, put out years ago. Mm-hmm. And it seems to have the best quality. It seems to have the best tracks and everything else. And that's I would think that one of the best things that exist. And if you go to Apple, which I'm a big fan of, as far as Apple Music is concerned, they have Spike Jonze Essentials. They have, you know, the starter type things. So I would also look there.
Fair enough. Those are, I mean, you know, that's always, as long as they get your seal of approval, then I happily will send people to a best of, because I have a few of his best of records. I mean, I think the one people have picked the most is the one, I feel like it's a Jack Davis cover. It's red background. It is Jack Davis, right? Yeah. Okay.
That's the first one. Right?
Yeah. And that's a great collection. And that, although I think my copy is in terrible condition, but okay, well, that's good. People should go there. Were there ever recordings when you did the shows? Did any of those get recorded?
What do you mean when I did the shows?
When you took over. Yeah. Did any of those get recorded?
No.
Okay.
And it's funny, I've never thought of it before, but no, there hasn't been.
Okay. That's too bad.
There were a couple of television appearances that I made. Danny Thomas was a very good friend of my parents. Mm-hmm. And my dad died in May, and Danny had a special on NBC in September. So it was all on comedy, and he invited me to and the band to participate. So
that's
amazing. I have a couple of shows in Yarnell's. I have those type of televised appearances.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, now I need to hunt them down. I feel bad that I didn't find them before now. I want to see these. I really want to see these too. Boy, oh boy. I don't even know what to say. This has been an absolute delight talking to you about this. Is there anything that we should leave the audience with about your dad, about your dad's career? Anything that we've forgotten that I haven't covered?
No, he would. I think you covered it really, really well, and the picture that you described was. I feel like I'm talking to Rachel Maddow. Was there anything that I didn't cover? You really drew the right picture of him, and it's difficult to put it all into. A Twitter paragraph or anything else. We're doing a series right now, which I'm unable to mention, but as I was telling the guys the other day, we have to show them how to sell it.
Sure.
They have no idea how to present Spike Jonze.
Of course.
In fact, half of them probably thinks it's the director.
Of course.
Jonze, you know, so that's going to be a disappointment to them right off the bat. But no, you did it terrific, and I love your show.
Thank you.
It's as many people do.
That's very kind of you.
And your logo is great.
Oh, thank you. I designed that one myself. I will take a little bit of credit for that. Yeah.
It pops. It's great.
Oh, thank you. I've been stuck designing all my logos for 20 years. So, you know, it's one of those things where I hoped it was good. Nobody's ever complimented it, so I'll take it.
Take it.
Very kind of you. Well, I will just tell everybody, please just go buy some Spike Jonze. Is there anything you want to promote? Anything you can talk about that you want to promote, where people can find you or anything else?
There are some videos on Amazon, The Best of Spike Jonze Volume 1, which is 60 clips from his television series, the 5 or 6 series, and it's just the cream of the crop. And you'll see what this stuff looked like live on live television.
I love it.
So that would be terrific.
Wonderful. One final thing, prop wise. So what was it? A starter pistol, a cap pistol, a blank shooting pistol? What was it?
22s and 38s. It was the real stuff.
Holy crap!
Because when he was playing. Auditoriums, a cap pistol or anything that small. I don't think he ever used that. He really wanted the punch. He wanted the shotgun in the trash can to really get that terrific effect. But he had quite a collection, and they were all big boy guns.
Wow, that's insane. I love it. Okay, I love hearing that. It's so funny. Again, thank you so much for doing the show. This has been
a delight. Please, thank you for doing it. And have a great rest of your summer.
Thank you. And thank you all for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years. Stolen Dress Entertainment.
Hey, it's my turn. Ah!